You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello and welcome to the cycling podcast Femina. My name is Rose Manley, and this month I'm joined by Orla Shenawy and Lionel Burney. Now, before we get on with the show, this is the first regular Feminan episode back since we lost our colleague, our linchpin, our friend, Richard Moore. The cycling podcast Feminan was a small part of the vast legacy that Richard left us with. We owe it to him and to our listeners to carry on, to continue to bring women's cycling alive, to show it the respect it deserves, and hopefully have some fun along the way. It will be hard, and by God, we will miss you, Richard. But I think we all know, with the buffalo sitting atop the cycling podcast logo, and through the things that he taught us, through the people he brought together, Richard, in some way, shape or form, will always be with us on the journey. And so let that journey begin now. And what better way than with Orla's news roundup?
Thanks, Rose. I just want to say before I start the news roundup, how lovely that was. Thanks for doing that, because I know it wasn't easy. And I know that Lionel's been back on the horse, or the buffalo maybe, but this is a difficult start, at least, to this podcast for all of us. I know it is. But we also know that Richard would be absolutely feckin' livid if we didn't crack on. So, crack on we shall. And just thank you everybody for keeping with us on the journey. We have to go, it feels really strange getting into a news roundup, but anyway, it's what we've got to do. It's not what we've got to do, it's what we love doing. That's the point. We have to go all the way back to Strade Bianche, believe it or not, to pick up where our last news roundup left off. And it's actually been really nice to go back through the spring and remember the incredible racing that we've had. Lotte Kopecky, do you remember, won a genuinely out-of-your-seat thriller of a two-up with Annemiek van Vleuten to tie in nicely with Richard's plan of doing a feature on Belgian women's cycling, something that we'll bring you most likely in the next episode. It's only been 5 months since the last Ronde van Drenthe, and defending champion Larina Vibes once again took the win, this time over Elisa Balsamo and Lotte Kopecky. At Trofeo Alfredo Binda, Elisa Balsamo took her first one-day race win since the World Championships last year, with Sofia Bertazzolo of Live Racing finishing second for the biggest result of her career, and Soraya Paladin of Canyon SRAM for arguably the biggest of hers, finishing in third. Balsamo then backed that up just 4 days later with a win at the OxyClean Classic Brugge de Panne, the filling in what would be a hat-trick sandwich of first-time wins for the world champion, with Larina Vibes in second and Marta Bastianelli in third. And then, 3 days after that, yes, you've guessed it, you probably remember already, Balsamo again took a Women's World Tour win, this time at Gent-Wevelgem, rounding off what must surely be one of the most successful weeks of racing of any pro cyclist. I have a question mark on my notes about that. I meant to look it up and I didn't. So you've got time to Google before I finish the news roundup. Marianne Vos finished in second with Maria Confalonieri finishing in third. Tour of Flanders then. What a beaut of a race, with the most romantic of winners, the Belgian national champion, taking the Belgian World Championships essentially. Lotte Kopecky winning the Ronde over Annemiek van Vleuten in a repeat result of Strade Bianche, with Chantal Vandenbroek-Black finishing in third. On to Amstel Gold. Marta Cavalli took the biggest win of her career so far, the first of the three Ardennes Classics, and it was a good one for her to win as well, wasn't it? The prize money this year matching the men's of €40,000. Demi Vollering of SC Works took second from the group 4 seconds back, while Leanna Lippert of Team DSM Women took third, with Annemiek van Vleuten falling just short of the podium. Paris-Roubaix Femme then, it's 2 from 2 for Trek Segafredo, not only for the win, but winning from a long solo attack as well. This time as Lizzie Deignan watched from home, no doubt. It was her teammate, Italian champion, Elisa Longoborghini, who went solo at 34 kilometres this time around to take the win, with Lotte Kopecky finishing in second and Lucinda Brand in third. We'll probably mention this, but another notable incident in that race was Elisa Balsamo puncturing almost crashing on her Chase back and then being disqualified after taking a sticky bottle from her team car. And not just for taking the sticky bottle, but for being caught on camera, essentially. The Flesh Wallonne winner's door was finally left open for someone new to come through after seven-time winner Anna van der Breggen retired. And it was Marta Cavalli who pushed her way through, beating Annemiek van Vleuten into the line and taking her second Ardennes win in 10 days. Jamie Vollering and Ashley Milman Passio finishing in third and fourth, both for Team SD Works. Liège-Bastogne-Liège then, and after 3 second places and an almost podium in fourth, Annemiek van Vleuten took her first Women's World Tour win of the season. That's her latest winning start to the Women's World Tour since 2018. She won after a 14-kilometre solo attack to take her second Liège-Bastogne-Liège, beating the chasing pack by 43 seconds, no less, with Grace Brown in second, Jamie Vollering in third. And it's worth mentioning that Brown's second for FDJ topped off a superb Ardennes campaign for the team after Cavalli won both Amstel and Flesh, while Vollering made it to the podium of every one of the three Ardennes Classics, but no win for the 2021 Liège champion. In other news briefly, Amy Peters has shown signs of consciousness after 4 months in a coma. SD Works released a statement saying that she can now communicate slightly, non-verbally, that she can recognise people and she understands what is being said. No doubt it's a long road ahead for her to recovery, but it is wonderful news and we wish her all the very best in her recovery. And finally, Annemiek van Vleuten has fractured her wrist after crashing in training. She underwent surgery the same day, but she will sit out the upcoming Spanish races where she usually goes so well. But apparently, she is still preparing for the Giro Donna and the Tour de France Femme as planned. And that, I believe, is your news roundup.
Well, Orla, plenty in your news roundup, and that means that we've got plenty of racing to get our teeth into in this episode, where we're going to be doing a little bit of a review of the spring classics season. But tell me, both of you, what has been your overall impression of this season compared to ones that we've seen before?
I don't know if it's a case of, you know, at the first week of the Tour de France, every year it feels like these years, we all declare it to be the most exciting first week of the Tour de France that anyone can remember ever, apart from last year and probably apart from next year. And so I don't know if I'm guilty of that, but I feel like this has been the most exciting spring season in women's cycling, certainly since I've covered it. And I don't think I'm misremembering past springs, but Just the dynamism of the racing and probably the fact that we've gotten to see so much more of it. And, you know, the complaints about how little we get to see of women's racing compared to men's racing are valid, but we're getting to see much, much more than before. But it just feels like we're at this lovely juncture of lots and lots of different riders winning, lots of different riders finishing on the podium, different teams now with enough strength to make it exciting. It used to be that women's racing was so exciting because it was completely unpredictable and it was a bit kamikaze. Now you've still got an element of that, but there's more control within it as well. But it's just been the most dynamic start to a season that I can remember. And I think it's been an absolute thriller.
Lionel, are you someone who likes the kind of varied winners, or are you someone who likes that? I guess it depends what kind of stance you have on bike racing. If you want to see one of those rivalries meeting race after race, or whether you want those varied winners, doesn't it, I guess?
Well, I think the thing that I took away from my trip to Paris-Roubaix, and I'll talk about this a bit more in the episode, is just how rapidly the team dynamics are evolving. I mean, we saw the sort of concentration of strength and power in SD Works and Trek, Segafredo particularly, and seeing those teams trying to sort of get the upper hand on one another and having various, you know, success in different races. But then how the teams with supposedly fewer resources are racing smarter as well. And the mix of riders in final groups, particularly in, I thought, Paris-Roubaix and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, you know, you didn't know exactly what was going to happen until it happened. I mean, it's all very easy to look back and say, well, Elisa Longo-Borghini, she attacked from a good distance out and was strong enough to hold on. Annemiek van Vleuten did the same in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Yeah, in hindsight, well, that was obvious, wasn't it? But at the time, there was that kind of sense of a mystery, really, and wondering how the teams are going to play the various cards that they've got. And again, you know, looking at, you know, SD Works, supposedly they've got, you know, multiple cards to play, but they didn't really manage to play them all that effectively. It wasn't that they made mistakes. That was the other thing. You know, they did kind of like, you know, the first couple of pages of the tactical manual, but the other teams and the other riders had an answer for it. And I thought that was the kind of evolving story over the, certainly the second half of the spring races that I saw. I suppose in the first half, Elisa Balsamo is becoming very difficult to beat in anything that comes down to any sort of sprint. And so it was good when the storylines kind of varied out a little bit in the second half of the spring.
I like that nobody was unbeatable. And maybe that's what feels fresher and newer compared to seasons gone past, when you do have, you know, ST Works for such a long time, Bols Dolmans were the unbeatable team until, you know, others were starting to rival them. But now that we do have our first season without Anna van der Breggen, there's a stranglehold that's been released, I think. And we'll come to this probably, but I had expected in many situations Annemiek van Vleuten to take the wins that Anna van der Breggen wasn't there to take, almost, you know, because you talk about the rivalries, Rose, and you know, you look at in the men's peloton, you've got Wout van Aert or Mathieu van der Poel, it's one or the other. So I just assumed, you know, Annemiek van Vleuten doesn't need Anna van der Breggen to not be there to win, but you kind of assume she's going to step in and grab all those extra races that are now going begging, and she hasn't done that, and I love that, you know. And even Balsamo, by the time she'd won her third race, you're thinking, oh, here we go, that's a spring written off, you know, she's going to keep winning with that gorgeous big smile of hers. But she didn't, you know, and then she's blinking kicked off Paris-Roubaix, which, you know, is terrible for her and terrible for, well, I was going to say terrible for the team, it wasn't really, they won, of course, but it was thrilling because it kept this jeopardy alive. And as you say, Lionel, even with Elisa Longo-Borghini winning Paris-Roubaix, which we'll talk about a little bit, but at one stage I was convinced that was it, her race was over, her gap came down to like within 10 seconds, and logic dictates that she's going to be swallowed up by the chasing pack and they're going to have to go afresh. But she stayed out front somehow, magically. So we've had the element of, like I say, jeopardy and mystery, as you say, Lionel, and intrigue pretty much to the line with most of these races, and it's been a bloomin' marvel.
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat or drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
The Cycling Podcast Femina, like the Cycling Podcast whole family of podcasts, is supported by Super Sapiens and the system of continuous glucose monitoring. You can't see because I'm wearing a long sleeve top, but I'm wearing my Super Sapiens sensor on my right upper arm. I'm going to be a guinea pig.
Get your arms out, Lionel. Come on, give the lady something to see. Come on.
Can I point out that it's not the fact you're wearing a long sleeve top that means that listeners can't see. It's a podcast.
That's true. Yeah. I was referring more to you two because we're talking on a video call.
It's more of a three-way conversation than outwardly. Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Sorry.
I mean, I'm the guinea pig on the podcast because throughout the Giro d'Italia, which I'm setting off for tomorrow, I'm going to be wearing the Super Sapien sensor. Ooh. And assessing my energy levels, seeing what the glucose numbers are, and seeing how the stresses and strains of covering a Grand Tour impact on my glucose levels, but more pertinently probably see how my refueling habits impact on my energy levels.
That's going to be fascinating during a Grand Tour, though, well, isn't it?
Late night meals and three courses.
Exactly. Double tiramisu after every stage.
Yeah. Well, at least you can say it's a science experiment now, Lionel. That gives you a good excuse, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's
exactly
true.
Exactly. As I've said on the Cycling Podcast in our Super Sapien slots, I have used the system before last summer. And, well, it gave me slight cause for concern because my spikes were quite spiky. And so it was one of the factors that convinced me that I needed to do something to alter my diet somewhat and lose a bit of weight. So I'm 20 kilos lighter now than I was when I first used the system. And already, I mean, I've only had it on my arm for a few days, but my spikes are more consistent, lower, my sort of energy dips are not as significant, and so it feels like I'm kind of leveling everything out and keeping my blood glucose in the optimum zone. So I'm looking forward to hearing what the Super Sapiens boffins, that's what we say, isn't it, about experts who know about scientific things. I'm looking forward to
if we're reading a comic book in the 80s. Yeah.
Exactly. They'll be there in their white lab coat analysing my figures.
and oversized spectacles.
Indeed. So if you're listening to the Giro coverage, which kicks off at the end of this week, you'll hear my Super Sapiens journey. And if you want to find out a bit more about how it all works, go to supersapiens.com.
Well, I did say that we were going to do a bit of a review of the Spring Classics. And I thought, what better way can we do that by each of us picking out a moment, a race, a rider, something significant that we've noticed from the Spring Classics already this season. So, Lionel, you know, you went out to Paris. Oh, well, I'm giving away what you're going to say actually now. Sorry about that. Lionel, tell us what your mysterious moment or race might be.
Well, Rose, at the start of March, I went to Strade Bianche. There we go. A curveball.
Now you're confused.
Oh.
Well, it kind of does tie in. It kind of does tie in because those two races are fantastic races. I mean, Strade Bianche is a modern classic. Paris-Roubaix is a classic. And the difference between the two experiences as a journalist on the ground could not be more different. Strade Bianche, the women's race is held in the morning. The men's race kind of comes, sort of overlaps with it. But they're both in completely different parts of the Tuscan countryside. It's impossible to be in two places at once. If you go over there as a journalist, it doesn't make a lot of sense to then just sit and watch the action in the press room. You want to get out, you want to go to the starts and the finishes and go out and see the action on some of the white roads. And it's just impossible to do that because the races are held on the same day. And so it really is a sort of, from the point of view of actually being there, it's quite tricky to cover both races adequately. Paris-Roubaix, with them both held on consecutive days over the weekend, is an absolutely out-of-this-world experience. I mean, it really is the kind of the blueprint for how the World Tour race organisers and the UCI should be looking at dovetailing the calendars. Because you get this feeling of two equally important races that happen over the weekend. And there was a real sense at the start in Denain on the Saturday morning that Paris-Roubaix had basically come of age in 6 months, isn't it? Because it was the October edition, was the first edition. I remember being there at the start in October and there was this kind of sense of anticipation, of curiosity. The riders themselves were going into the unknown. They didn't really know how the race would play out. They didn't know what would be possible, what would be unachievable. Obviously, we saw Lizzie Deignan take it on right from the first, pretty much the first cobblestone. And there was a real sense in Denain on the Saturday morning that tactically the riders were aware that that couldn't happen again and that the race was going to be different. Obviously, the weather was different. The wind conditions were different. You know, that has a lot to say when it comes to the way Paris-Roubaix works out. But there was a real sense that teams had plans and that they were going to put those plans into action against one another. And of course, the finest made plans can be completely ripped up if one of your opponents chooses to do something different. So there was this sense of a really great storyline was going to be written on the Saturday, and we just didn't know what was going to happen. And so to see the way the race unfolded, and it was both a sledgehammer attack from Elisa Longo Borghini, but as you say, you know, it did nearly come back. I didn't think necessarily it would come back because that gap is still so hard to close and there wasn't quite the cooperation. But tactically, it was such a sophisticated race. You know, there was so much going on. And of course, you know, Trek Segafredo, they played it absolutely perfectly. Okay, we have to kind of gloss over Elisa Balsamo getting disqualified.
No, we don't. That's one of the highlights of the race. I love that. But I love that frailty. I love the fact that I don't like a perfect performance by a team. I think that's wonderful, really.
I did feel, actually, when you're watching bystander, it, that their kind of Trek Segafredo's options seem to be getting narrower and narrower up until that Elisa Longo Borghini attack, because it seemed like Chloe Hoskin crashed, Ellen Van Dijk had a puncture, Balsamo got disqualified. And so it felt like, you know, all of their kind of players, or, you know, all of these people who'd be being the best domestics you could find, seemed to be getting fewer and fewer and fewer. And they were going to be struggling to find, you know, how many plans could they have come up with? How many different scenarios could they have come up with? So I think it was kind of an opportunistic move from Elisa Longo Borghini when she did move. And it was surprising for me, because I did think that SD Works seemed to have so much under control up until that point. But it turned round that it seemed that they'd been burning too many matches, because, you know, they were left in a situation where they had Capecchi and Chantal van der Black, and both of them had either been in a breakaway, a really forceful breakaway, or they'd been doing a lot of work on the front. And then you felt like, well, who's the person who's been saving their legs here?
Yeah, well, the big problem for SD Works was that they had a rider in exactly the right position when Longo Borghini attacked, but it was just the wrong rider, wasn't it? It was Elena Cecchini. And so, you know, she wasn't going to work. But she was, you know, it put SD Works from a very strong position into actually quite a weak position straight away. I always felt, I mean, we recorded an episode of Arrivé, myself and Lizzie Banks, after that race, and my head was absolutely swimming, you know, trying to get my head around what had happened in the race and how it had all gone. And I think that's the best races are like that. For 1 minute, you just can't make head nor tail of it. And then all of a sudden, as you start talking about it or boiling down the key points, what really were the 3-4 key moments in, say, the last 50 or last 75 kilometers, and suddenly they all become clear, and you can kind of make sense of it, you know, when previously it looked like absolute chaos. And that's exactly how that edition of Paris-Roubaix felt to me, really. It suddenly all made sense. Admittedly, when Lizzie started talking, I must admit.
Yeah, it does help, doesn't it?
But isn't that the beauty of Paris-Roubaix anyway, though? The utter chaos. And I mean, the word unpredictable is, I was going to say overused when it comes to Paris-Roubaix, but it can't be, you know, because it is so entirely unpredictable at every single given moment, you know? And you're saying, Rose, about Trek sort of losing options as they go. But I remember asking, before we started recording in the Eurosport studio, I asked Magnus Backstead, how many plans does a team have going into Paris-Roubaix? And he was like, you've got to go through to Zed, but you don't have all the riders to get you to Zed. Like, you've got to rip up plans, you know, at every cobble sector almost. And I just absolutely love that. And Lionel, I'm so glad that you say that it's a joy to cover on the ground, because so often bike races, not so often actually, but sometimes it can be more of a challenge, and so they become disappointing almost to cover in person, and you get to see a lot more when you're watching on the TV. But I feel like Paris-Roubaix now, as a weekend of racing, is absolutely the best weekend of sport of the entire year. And this is probably quite sacrilegious of me to admit, but I could almost take or leave men's Paris-Roubaix before. I found it really interesting, but it was up there with Flanders or even Milan-San Remo. I know a lot of people call it boring, but you know, it was up there with all the others, essentially, all the classics, you know, until women's Paris-Roubaix last year. And I wasn't sure if it was because it was the first and because I had that goosebumps all day and because I felt that weight of history that I thought maybe this is why it's so special, but it's not. It's because you get to that weekend and that's it. You sit down first thing in the morning, you know, you get yourself settled in, you get your bum all cozy in the chair, and you are ready for two full solid days of chaotic racing that, you know, whatever the weather, whatever the outcome, is going to be beautiful. It's going to be the very essence of why we love road racing. And the fact that the women's race has all that time to breathe, and it's not a warm-up for the men's race at all. It's just part of it. It's just a part of the entire weekend, which is a celebration and a festival of road cycling. And I find it now, this year, I feel like it's consolidated that place in my soul. I feel like it's taken on a different level. And that's because we have a women's race. And it's because we have a women's race on a separate day where it's got time to have its own identity, albeit one that's tied to the men's race. But I think Paris-Roubaix as a weekend night is the greatest that there is, really.
I mean, I don't know what you think, but surely that has to be the blueprint for other race organisers. I mean, the big excuse was there's lots of the men's World Tour races where there's also a fairly lucrative sportive attached to the weekend, and that tends to take out Saturday. Well, at Paris-Roubaix, they had the sportive on the Saturday, and it was out of the way before the women's race. So it is possible. They certainly at Paris-Roubaix, it's possible.
We're actually lucky that it is like that, because I think they had it on Saturday and Sunday just because of some strange quirk, wasn't it, last year? And they'd actually said after we had that October edition that next time it was going to be back to, well, not back to normal, but it was going to follow the pattern of most races where they have the women's and then the men's, or I guess at Tour de France they have them the other way around now. But I actually don't know what it was that changed their mind on that, but we are lucky that they changed their minds on it and went back to having it the women's on the Saturday and the men's on the Sunday instead of having both on the Sunday.
Yeah, there was a period when that was the case, and my heart kind of sank, really, because it did detract from the weekend. Certainly the point of being at the races is to go out and experience them. You know, from our point of view as journalists, we want to be at the start, at the finish, and if possible with the classics out on the course, just to capture a bit of the sound and spirit and soul of these events. And putting them on consecutive days is definitely the way ahead as far as I can see. So maybe some other classics will the organisers, whether it be RCS or Flanders Classics, will look at the success of Paris-Roubaix and realise that it probably is a smart play, for future editions. We can only hope.
I think it gives women's cycling the maturity that it already has. You know, it credits the maturity, I should say, because if you look at, for example, the Flanders Classics and the Tour of Flanders. I mean, Flanders Classics rightly gets a lot of praise for the work that it proactively does to try to level up. But if you look at the Tour of Flanders, for example, okay, so they put the women's race on after the men's race. And again, that was a quirk of scheduling. It wasn't to give more prominence to women's racing. It just worked out then to benefit the women's race because they were able to keep viewers from the men's race still watching then the women's race. However, it still leaves me a little bit flat. I can't fully invest in Women's Tour of Flanders because I can't watch it, you know? And I'm still trying to digest the men's race as we're suddenly thrown into maybe 60 kilometres to go of a race that I don't know what's happened until then. I haven't invested yet and my head is still trying to work out what's just been. As you say, Lionel, after a race, your head's in a spin. And so... It might work for viewer numbers on the television, but it doesn't work as a viewer, I think, or it certainly doesn't work as someone who wants to fully consume women's cycling. But I'd be curious as to what you both think about the likes of the suggestion now that we would have a men's Milan-San Remo, for example,
I think that sounds like a crazy idea, Orla. Men couldn't possibly do that kind of distance.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, that's it. Doesn't that say everything that my default is the woman's, and then if we're doing something different, it has to be the men's version? What I meant was let's revert to how society views things, which is men is the default. That they're thinking of doing a women's Milan-San Remo, and our friend Tilda Price was on Twitter earlier and sort of pointing out, which is something that I've alluded to quite a lot anyway, is whether women's racing should always be aping the successful men's races. Or whether it should be consolidating what it's got. And I fear a women's Milan-San Remo, okay, fine. But the peloton is so stretched as it is. We want to see quality racing and a cohesive calendar rather than more and more races added on top, because it makes sense for that race organiser to add another race and to be seen to be adding a women's race.
Just a point of order from the elder statesman of our trio by some distance, I should say. There has been a women's equivalent of Milan-San Remo. The Primavera Rosa was held between 1999 and 2005, I think it was. It was traditionally the first European round of the World Cup back then, and it was held on the same course. And
the same distance?
Not the same. It started...
But
south. It was a shortened course, but it was held over the same finale as Milan-San Remo. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, Cipressa and Poggio. And, I mean, you know, it was a big race at the time. You know, as I say, the opening European round of the World Cup, I think the World Cup in those times used to start in Australia with rounds in either Canberra or Sydney or... I can't remember exactly where they were held at the time, quite a while ago now. But it was always an aggressive race, and you'd see a few minutes of it perhaps on Eurosport in the sort of sports roundup. There wouldn't be live coverage of it. But then in the UK, in some of those years, there wasn't live coverage of men's Milan-San Remo either. So, I mean, it's not all that long ago that the men's cycling didn't get the level of exposure that it now gets in certainly the UK market. But, I mean, only, I think, of those six editions, I think only three ended in sprint finishes. The other three were attacks. Susanna Lundskog of Sweden attacked on the Poggio, right at the top of the Poggio in 2001. And Zulfia Zabirova, the Russian rider, did the same thing 2 years running in 03 and 04. She attacked on the Cipressa and held on to win by about 30 seconds or so. I think the bigger problem for having a women's edition of Milan-San Remo now is that the Trofeo Alfredo Binda has taken that slot the day before, sorry, in this case, the day after Milan-San Remo. And I mean, that is a cracking race on a really good course. And I do think that there has to be some kind of oversight from somebody, you would like to think the UCI, to preserve what already is great about the women's calendar and you know, add to and augment that, not kind of just create a sort of unmanageable race program for the teams. Because let's not forget, the teams are half the size of men's teams, and we're getting to a point where, with all the stage racing that's going on between now and the Tour de France in the end of July, there's a significant race program to be covered. And with the illness that's been sweeping through not just the women's peloton, it's a phenomenon in the men's peloton this year as well. It only takes, what, a couple of illnesses, an injury, and teams are down to the bare bones to even fill the rosters for some of these races. So whilst growth is fantastic, there has to be someone looking at how to make all of this growth you know, sustainable, and make sure that it dovetails well together so that we're not being asked to you know, pick and choose and frankly make the wrong choices. I mean, I'm not going to have a pop at something like the Tour of Romandy on the men's calendar, but that is a week that really could be used for a very high profile women's race, and so that the men's and women's calendars are dovetailing and almost kind of you know, like hitting a ball over a tennis net, you know, so that the focus goes from one to the other, because, you know, the focus doesn't need to be on the men's stage racing the whole time. But like I say, I don't look at the UCI and think that there's a tremendous kind of certainly public facing vision in terms of, you know, laying out how this should all work, because it's not about what happens this year or next year. It's about what is this all going to look like in 5 years, 10 years time, yeah, where hopefully the sport, yeah, has matured.
What's
to a point
and
where,
what's the goal? Yeah,
exactly.
Work back, exactly, from that. Yeah.
In their defense, I've looked at it. I've sat down with a blank sheet of paper. I've tried to kind of make the perfect calendars, and it's absolutely impossible. So,
well, if you can't do it, Lionel, then we're screwed. Let's give up and go home. I'll take my ball back.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, thank you to our sponsors, Science in Sport, for their continuing support of this podcast and all of the other podcasts in the Cycling Podcast family, of course. If you're looking for 25% off Science in Sport products, and why the hell would you not want that, then go to scienceinsport.com and type in the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Right, we've had Lionel's pick, which was, he almost threw us a curveball though there when we thought he was going to say Paris-Roubaix, and then he said Strade Bianche and then he said Paris-Roubaix again. But that's kind of the nature of the ever-changing Spring Classic season. But Orla, what was your moment or highlight or race or rider that you want to kind of focus on that has kind of piqued your interest?
There have genuinely been so many, and I'd love to talk about Lotte Kopecky, or indeed the joy of Alisa Balsamo, and it sounds and feels ridiculous to call this a breakthrough year for Balsamo when she came into the season as world champion, but it has been really, but I'm not going to talk about those things. I'm actually going to be very cheeky and talk about or start this with a race that's not on the Women's World Tour, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. Because
you're taking our memories, stretching our memories all the way back.
Yeah, all the way back. But I'm going to take you all the way forward.
Oh.
Come on a journey with me through the spring. Partly because I loved how that race played out. I found it really fun. Mm. And the fact that it shouldn't have been won in the way it was brilliant. Let me remind you, of course, it was Annemiek van Vleuten who essentially was her own lead-out train over Demi Vollering. She should not have been in that sprint finish, really, having led Vollering out for 100 kilometres and not needing a turn at the front and not getting a turn at the front. That little flick of the elbow to Vollering, who went, I don't know, 5 pedal strokes in front of her and then sat back in the wheel again.
But what I remember most clearly is Demi Vollering's face. Do you remember when she's just sitting in Annemiek van Vleuten's wheel and she's just, her head is shaking and she looks exhausted. She was like, she couldn't believe that she was, couldn't go.
That she was still going.
Yeah, couldn't even get around van Vleuten to try and contribute. She couldn't even try and contribute. It was so remarkable. Yeah.
But you just would have expected in that finish that Vollering, with the fastest sprint finish, would have had all the energy conservation to bring her forward, and she didn't, and it was a beautiful win. But part of the reason I want to flag that is because it made me think what I alluded to earlier, which was in the absence of Anna van der Breggen, this was going to be the spring for Annemiek van Vleuten, and that she would sweep up all of these wins that had been left there for the gathering. And she didn't. So actually the beatability of Annemiek van Vleuten, what, that's not a word. I'm aware of that, which is why I paused. But anyway, I find that really interesting. But, you know, 3 second places and some of them are incredibly close, and ones that we would have expected her to win, Strade Bianche being one of them, 1 fourth place. And the fact that she didn't win until Liège-Bastogne-Liège and then won it in such dramatic style, you know, with a huge solo breakaway. But I find that really quite indicative, I think, of where we are, because even van Vleuten actually, after Liège-Bastogne-Liège, said that she's never felt better in the spring than she feels right now. And yet she had to wait till Liège before she got her win. That is the strength of the women's peloton and just how difficult it is to win a women's bike race right now. I absolutely love that. I should say that the last time she won, she left it this late to win, rather, a Women's World Tour race in 2018. She did finish off by being time trial world champion. So I don't think she's going to be in any panic whatsoever. Unfortunate, of course, that she's now fractured her wrist and has needed surgery and can't compete in the Spanish races. But then leads us, you know, into ever more intrigue ahead of the Tour de France Femmes, which will, I think, be the focal point of the season for many of us, certainly from a narrative point of view anyway. But yeah, it was that win at Omloop, and the fact that she was, when we say someone's invincible, can we say vincible?
Why not?
The fact that she's vincible was really exciting, but also the fact that she's bookended her spring with wins just excites me. Really,
but we should also remember, I mean, she hasn't really done an extensive spring season. She hasn't done quite as many races a lot of her rivals have done, but we should also remember that she did have a crash in Paris-Roubaix in October last year, where she had a fractured hip, a broken shoulder, and I think her recovery was actually a lot quicker than was first anticipated, but for her to have come into this season
And to have got the results that she's got is incredibly impressive, I think.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that she's under-delivered or underperformed. Mm. Like I say, she did 3 second places and a fourth. She's been right up there. It's more the fact that there are certain situations now where before I would have thought this is hers for the taking. No one will be able to beat her. And she's been beaten. And yet she's still so strong. It's not that she's getting weaker, you know, it's not that she's losing her edge in any way. It's just that the women's peloton has raised up another level again, which is what's exciting.
I did wonder perhaps that maybe they have lost Leah Thomas from the Movistar team. Obviously, she's gone to Trek. And I think people also know Emma Norsgaard a lot better than they did last year. I think Emma Norsgaard for Movistar was kind of a surprise package. And it meant that Annemiek could kind of sit back and relax knowing that Norsgaard could always win in a sprint. I think now the other teams are a lot more aware of that dynamic between Emma Norsgaard and Annemiek van Vleuten. And I do think that Leah Thomas is a bit of a loss to the Movistar team because she's such a good... climbing domestique. I think even in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, when Van Vleuten made that first attack on La Redoute, then the person who was at the front of the group behind was Leah Thomas. She was her former teammate, who was the person who bridged across to Van Vleuten and kind of foiled that initial attack that she made. In the end, it didn't matter because she just made another attack, obviously. and won it anyway. But I did wonder if that slight change to the team dynamic might have meant that some of those second places might have been first. Maybe she could have conserved a little more energy. Maybe she would have been in a slightly better position in some of them. Perhaps, I don't know. What does everyone else think about that?
I don't know. I think that kind of thing is almost written by the results, really, because we were praising Movistar's new strength and depth in, if not the last episode, then the one before. You know, they were top of the Women's World Tour for the first time ever. So I think maybe that's something that we're projecting on to the fact that she hasn't won as much. But obviously, Leah Thomas will be a big loss.
That's our job, but Orla. We're think projecting. That, I think that... That's the job of this, just to project.
Very true. But I think Movistar have a good setup. I think they're looking strong. And I think Annemiek van Vleuten, once she starts to win again, then that becomes the dominant narrative, doesn't it? Which she has done, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but unfortunately fractured her wrist since then.
I mean, 11 race days this year, and she's been in the top four on 8 of those days. That is not too shabby. And Lizzie Banks took exception to me saying that Liège-Bastogne-Liège kind of salvaged her spring, because she'd come up short in most of the other classics, hadn't she? I mean, Strada Bianca, she was done at the finish, but if you'd had to say, I thought, that was an upset at the time. I mean, again, seeing what Lotta Kopecky did subsequently puts a different spin on that. At the Tour of Flanders, again, you know, less of a surprise, perhaps. I also thought it was an upset on the Mer de Huy. I don't want to spoiler anyone else who wants to pick their moments of the spring, Rose. But
Massive, though. You know, that's one I would have had her name down for sure.
I just thought this is Van Vleuten's in the right position all the way up this climb, and then suddenly she wasn't. That was really interesting to see. But Liège-Bastogne-Liège, if any course favours a kind of a tactical plan that is absolutely unequivocal and the strength to carry it out, it's that course, isn't it? That stretch from La Redoute to the finish is very, very hard. But she, I think Lizzie, I feel like I'm just stealing Lizzie Banks's points here, but she made a very good point.
Well, that's what she's here for. It's fine. Lizzie,
what mind? It's nice that you're giving her credit, though, yeah. Lionel.
Many would just nick it and say nothing, Lionel. You're a man of honour.
You say, as my time as a female professional cyclist, I can tell you that's what you should be
exactly,
going for.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just it was. See if we notice.
It was the old-fashioned 1-2. You know, the boxing blow, the kind of the big left, but then keeping the big right, assuming she's right-handed. Van Vleuten, I don't know actually, but you get what I'm saying.
Depends,
you know,
which wrist she's hurt as well.
Yeah, oh dear, I'm getting into trouble here, aren't I? But she kind of. You know, she delivered a sort of, you know, 80% blow on Lara Dute, knowing that she still had something else left, and then sort of cemented it on the Côte de Rochefoucauld, and then time trialed to the finish. And I've made this point about the men's race as well, but that finish is so hard to chase on. I think if you're out in front, we've seen it quite a few times in both the men's and the women's races, the pendulum does swing in favour of a strong rider out in front, just because the roads are so, you know, there's nothing in them. They're really hard to ride on anyway. They just demand 100% commitment to the cause. And if you're the sole rider out in front, then you've got nothing else but to give 100%, whereas there's always that little bit of doubt in the chase behind. I think we saw that again, another kind of tactically subtle chase, wasn't it? Because no one wanted to overcommit and blow their chances at the finish. So even though I think it was FDJ and SD Works both had two riders, didn't they, in that chase group? You know, it wasn't as simple as just saying, well, there's six of one and one up there, so the strength should be with the chasers. It was a real fascinating run in that. And back to your point, all about seeing more of these races, you know, we can only judge it on the context of like the 45K or so that we saw. It'd be really interesting to know the kind of attritional damage that was done in the early part of the race and how the stronger teams use that strength in the bit of the race that we didn't see, because I've got the sense and the feeling that's how those races are won, when they get really hard at the end. It's all of the effort that's saved in the first third of the race, the first half of the race.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by MAP, who are our clothing partners. They came on board at the start of the year, and Rose Orler, if you can see just behind me on the wall now, I've got the pink jersey from the Giro d'Italia, and
a very nice
deep blue MAP jersey.
I'd say it's an Yves Klein blue, isn't it?
Is that right? I mean, I defer to your knowledge of shades of blue there.
Right.
We'll go with that.
But I think you'll agree.
Blank faces, dear listener.
It looks magnificent. It's really nice to wear as well. It's one of the lighter weight jerseys for, probably ideal for the English summer. I guess down in Australia, where MAP was founded, they probably wear that in the winter and, you know, quite warm and toasty and comfortable. But MAP have come on board, and we have a collaboration, which I can tease a little bit, lined up for later on in the year. We'll be announcing that during the Tour de France in July. But until then, you just have to wait and guess what the extent of our collaboration will be. I mean, there'll be a jersey. There'll be a Cycling Podcast jersey. There, I've said too much. Sorry.
It would be very strange if it wasn't connected to a jersey, to be fair. If we were chatting a new handbag range or something.
Well,
so
we
don't worry,
see.
It's not too much of a spoiler.
We shall see. Check out map.cc, that's MAAP.cc. Have a look at all of the beautiful clothing. I wore most of the deep winter clothing on my recent cycle tour around Scotland. It didn't get above about sort of 9-10 degrees all week, so I needed to be kept warm. I mean, the winter gloves are absolutely remarkable in the sense that you can ride for 4 or 5 hours in them and they just don't let water in. That was quite extraordinary for me. And if you ride off-road as well, or do a bit of gravel riding, the new Alt Road collection is worth checking out. And go to map.cc to see the whole range of MAP jerseys, shorts, winter clothing, summer clothing. You name it, they do it. And casual clothing, in fact. I'm taking a bag of T-shirts out to the Giro for Daniel and I to wear while we're strolling around in Italy, looking the part.
Drinking post 11 o'clock cappuccinos. Yeah. Cappuccini.
I was teeing you up for the smart, deprecating comment there, but it didn't come. There we are.
No, I think you both look beautiful. I'm looking forward to it. You're looking really well.
Yves Klein blue. Which I have just checked that is correct. So
I was wondering what you were Googling there. I heard you tapping furiously. She trying to correct Lionel's take on map clothing.
You say that. I have actually gone down a clothing size lately. So yeah, I'm feeling pretty confident.
I'm not surprised, Lionel. You're genuinely looking really trim.
Feeling confident to crack out the map clothing and look like it. You know, yeah, wear it well. I think that's the aim.
Yeah, you're going to own that.
Let's get back to the cycling. Rose, what was your moment of the spring? I imagine it was something in the Ardennes, perhaps.
It could have been, Lionel. But now, because I feel like with both of you, you both said what you were going to say, and then you both started a bit like, all a minute ago, was like, oh, Lottie, Kopecky, blah, blah. So I wonder if I should have just said to come up with something else on the top of my head. But no. I'm not going to. I've just spent all that time looking up Eve Klein on Wikipedia that I'm just, you know, going to go with what I was going to always say. But I do want to focus in on a very particular moment, which was that moment when Marta Cavalli was on the shoulder of Annemiek van Vleuten on the Mer de Huy, right at the top. And, you know, as you said, Orla, we thought that Annemiek would have had it in the bag, but we just had seeing Marta Cavalli right on her shoulder. And I thought, this is such a perfect moment for illustrating that kind of changing of the guard that I think is kind of happening this season with Anna van der Breggen, who won Flèche Wallonne 7 times, now not being at the race, and having a new champion in Marta Cavalli, a 24-year-old rider, a rider who... I think, obviously, she won Amstel Gold Race just a few days before, or a week before, when the calendar changed, didn't it, this season?
10 days before, I think.
10 days before.
Yeah.
So, obviously, she won Amstel Gold 10 days before. But sometimes Amstel Gold Race does turn up a kind of winner that you might not be expecting. So, I think to see her talent and ability kind of confirmed by following up on the Mer de Huy, I thought that was incredibly impressive. And it also just kind of showed me that I think she, in that Amstel Gold Race, she took the advantage of the fact that Cecily Uttrup-Ludwig, Brody Chapman were both taken out with illness, and so they didn't start. So normally I think the responsibility of being the team leader and of getting the result would have fallen on Cecily Uttrup-Ludwig. So to see Marta Cavalli kind of take up that opportunity and show herself to be... a great champion in that moment, I think, shows just how the peloton is evolving. And with Anna van der Breggen now out of the picture, that to see some of these younger riders coming through and being the stories of the day, I think that shows you what the rest of the season might hold.
Rose, you say that moment at... the very end of Flèche Wallonne, top of Mer de Huy, that was the moment that you thought the changing of the guard. But did you think that when Marta Cavalli was coming up and approaching Annemiek van Vleuten, did you think at that stage Cavalli could have this? Because I didn't.
I didn't.
Classic. There's no way Annemiek can be beaten in this situation. She is the strongest, and it's a valiant effort, but Annemiek van Vleuten has got this in the bag.
No, this is very much me coming up with a nice little neat package with the help of hindsight.
Tied up with pretty bow.
Yes, because I honestly really didn't think that. But it always watching Flèche Wallonne always surprises me how long the Mer de Huy is.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I always think, okay, that's...
Especially the last bit, which sounds ridiculous. Yeah, but that last bit was on forever. It's like a 10-metre stretch. It's 200 metres long.
Yeah, I've been to the Mer de Huy number of times. I've been to the race. I've walked all the way up it, filmed every single corner, all of this kind of boring stuff.
Did you come out of a black hole at the top, though?
Just...
Did you come out in another space-time dimension?
And then saw everything from the view of hindsight. But no, but it still surprised me watching it that you think it's over and you have to really be so patient on it. And I think that's what Anna van der Breggen was always the queen of, being so patient and measuring her effort so carefully, because she always kept a little bit more for that bit when it flattens out right at the very, very last. She would always have a little bit more energy to go and a little bit of a sprint right at the end there. Oh, sprint, I say a sprint, but you know what I mean. She could still move her legs a little quicker at the end. So I think to win there is an incredibly impressive achievement for Marta Cavalli, and kind of shows an experience beyond her years. But I think when you do have someone like Annemiek van Vleuten, then you know that you just need to hang on to the back of her wheel and then fingers crossed you have something at the end, don't you? Because she's going to be just, the, like, yeah.
Just need to hang on to Annemiek van Vleuten's wheel.
Because I think that's the mistake.
Somebody call the ambulance.
Yeah, when you saw, when we were watching Amstel Gold Race, I think that is the mistake that Esti Works made in that moment, which opened up the opportunity for Marta Cavalli to win there. Because that, again, that's the Kalberg, although it's a slightly different finish to Flèche Wallonne because it's much flatter for about a kilometre at the end of the race. But it was on the Kalberg when they were going up, it was kind of a reduced group that had become reduced because Van Vleuten had, you know, made some huge attack, had narrowed down the group, and then Demi Vollering and Ashley Moorman-Pasio were just watching Van Vleuten, and they weren't looking at anyone else. And it was exactly at that moment that Moorman-Pasio turned her head to watch Van Vleuten, was when Marta Cavalli came up along the left-hand side and just went shooting off past her. So I think in a way, when you have a race like Flèche Wallonne, I think I might be just contradicting what I've just been saying, possibly. But hopefully no one will bother re-listening. But so I think that Flèche Wallonne, I think if you know that you can, well, you don't know that you can hang on to Annemiek van Vleuten, but if you can keep her in your sights and then just hope that at the end you have something more to give, then you can win. But I think a lot of the time people are too impatient to do that. So I thought that it showed great maturity in Marta Cavalli's riding that she was able to not jump the gun and was able to kind of cement her status as a rider to watch.
And great strength as well. You just saw Annemiek van Vleuten's head bobbing from side to side. She was pulling the bike underneath her, wasn't there? Wasn't she, from left to right? And it just showed the effort that a rider of her power was putting in behind, just made the win visibly and visually so much more remarkable.
And we should say about, you know, Marta Cavalli, her results in the other races as well. I mean, she got fifth in Paris-Roubaix and sixth in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So I think she has really flourished this year. Although I did go back at last year's results and she did get 17 top 10 finishes last year. But obviously,
we've talked about her a lot.
Yeah, we do. But if it's not, you know, if it's not a win, then I think people don't look, you never have that target on your back, do you? So obviously that she's really had a breakthrough just in the last few weeks.
And I wondered, with the Murderhui being such a test of that patience and timing and just getting it right, because there's so little margin for error, really, whether the fact that she'd already won at Amstel Gold just loosened the shoulders a little bit, you know, get the first one and the second one just seems to come that little bit more easily. You know, perhaps just less intimidated by the fact that it's Van Vleuten that she's, you know, going directly up against. I mean, that's into the realms of speculation, but we do see this. Riders get their first big win and the second one comes along relatively quickly.
I guess it's always going to help.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
It's always going to help the team strategy, though, isn't it? I mean, when you're a team and you've got someone who's already won in the Ardennes, whether Amstel is the Ardennes or not, we won't bother going into now, but I would say it was. So that's what we're going to say.
Because it's not.
Like I said, Lionel, we're not going to go into it now. So I wish there was a...
I will concede it's one of the Ardennes classics, even though it's not in the Ardennes.
Okay, no, well,
that's what we need. It comes under the umbrella of Ardennes classics. It doesn't matter where it is, really.
It's just,
that's irrelevant.
So if you've won a race recently, is what I'm going to say then, and you're racing a similar style of race, then
A similar umbrella of a name, for example,
then I think it probably does help for the team to know that you obviously have good form. You can take the responsibility of being the team leader, whereas they might have looked to Brody Chapman, say, to do that. And also, I mean, I noticed in that Flèche Wallonne,
FDJ did miss that a kind of early break. They're one of the few teams to not be featured in that break. And they did put Brodie Chapman on the front to bring it back. Whether they may would have made that same decision, not, you know, without the understanding that Marta Cavalli could win that race or had a very good chance of winning that race, you know, it's hard to say, isn't it? But I think certainly it's bound to change the team tactics if you've got a recent winner amongst your ranks, especially if the winner isn't someone that you're expecting to be, I think.
I think that's a very good point. And it gives me an opportunity to say that for FDJ, you know, she made herself into a horse that was worth backing, Cavalli, didn't she?
Yeah,
another horse based pun. Just stealing Lizzie Banks' thunder there with a horse based pun.
You know, we're hoping to, I don't know if we've asked her yet, but we're hoping to use Lizzie Banks a little bit more on the cycling podcast, Femina, going forward. So I'm hoping that, Lionel, you haven't scuppered those plans. Or maybe this is actually the invite that she needed. She's going to come on and give you what's what and steal all of her own words.
Well, maybe we just need to get your own. Exactly. Maybe we just need to get Lionel a wig, though. Have we considered that? Just, that might also just work as well. And then Lionel can just steal Lizzie's intellectual property. Instead.
It's just a cunning ploy to get Lizzie to come on and make her own points herself instead of having me do them.
Well done, Lionel. Who needs to pick up the phone anyway?
Yeah.
Personal human contact is so overrated. Lizzie, if you're listening for long enough to be offended by Lionel stealing your words, will you come on the Cycling Podcast Femina a little bit more? Thanks very much.
Excellent. Can I just make one final point about the racing? It's not World Tour racing, but it was the Grand Prix Elsie Jacobs this week, wasn't it, in Luxembourg? And it just took me back to one of my very first appearances on one of the very first episodes of the Cycling Podcast Femina, because people might not remember. I was actually included in the very first few episodes, wasn't I, Orla? I did a little an explainer about something from the world, the historical world of women's cycling.
How terrible to say. I'd forgotten that. And that's true.
One of the first was just to explain who Elsie Jacobs was, because she was the first winner of the UCI Women's World Championship Road Race in 1958. That was the first time they held a road race for women, and Elsie Jacobs from Luxembourg won it. She also broke the hour record later that year, and that record stood until 1972, 14 years, that is. And the race is held in her hometown, Garnick. She passed away a number of years ago now. When would that have been? That would have been in the 90s, I think, she passed away, Elsie Jacobs. But the race was held this week, wasn't it? And the reason it caught my eye was because Anna Henderson won the prologue time trial. And just to bring everything back to me, Anna Henderson has overtaken me on more than one occasion riding around the lanes of Not Watford.
Wow.
Because she's based in or around Hertfordshire, certainly over the winter anyway. I know she visits some of the cycling cafes around here. So that result caught my eye. Her biggest win to date for Jumbo-Visma. So maybe we should catch up with her over the winter.
If you can catch her, that's go for a problem ride though, Lionel. She keeps overtaking you.
Yeah, that is a problem, isn't it? Maybe do the interview in the cafe rather than on the bikes. That would make it easier for me, I think.
Well, you trying to train to catch up with Anna Henderson, be it on a cafe or on a road, Lionel, sounds like a great plan for a winter target, if we don't happen to talk to her before then. But what have we got planned coming up before then?
Well, it's a very good point, Rose. Our plans are somewhat fluid at the moment. The only thing that's certain is our commitment to the Cycling Podcast Féminin, which, as you know, Richard was the driving force instrumental in creating back in 2016. We talked about it. How do we incorporate more women's coverage into the cycling podcast, coverage of cycling in general? And Richard was very determined to have a separate show, at least initially, to give the space for stories to develop and, you know, the same level and depth of coverage, rather than shoehorning it into a segment in the regular cycling podcast. And we discussed this, and we have continued to discuss this over the years. I know, Orla, we've had discussions about this as well, haven't we, at various times. But the commitment was to a show that was dedicated to women cycling, but with a kind of a longer term goal to break down the distinction between men's cycling and women's cycling. And that's something that certainly Richard has inspired me to appreciate more. I mean, I've always watched women's cycling. I've always taken an interest and I've listened to the cycling podcast Feminin. But I think we, you know, the sport in general, as I said earlier, needs to start thinking about how the two halves of the greater whole can dovetail together. And certainly here on the Cycling Podcast, we were thinking about ways to begin that process or continue that process at a faster pace. And I suppose the creation of Arrivé over the spring, which was our kind of knee-jerk reactions to the races, the intention was to include the women's classics in that as well. We did that. I'm glad we did that. And I'm very grateful to Lizzie Banks for joining me on those shows for Paris-Roubaix, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And so we need to all sit down and talk about how we continue that process, because really that is the greatest strength of Richard's legacy, instilling in me and I'm sure many other people an interest in what was originally and initially a kind of neglected side of the sport, and which is no longer neglected. And so our commitment to that is absolute, and we're going to have to think of ways to do it. But I'm sure as a team, we will rise to the task over the coming months and years.
Lionel, it's also really, really encouraging, I think, and indicative of where the Cycling Podcast as an entity is, that you've been so willing as well to be that link, I guess, because I was always really heartened by the fact that not only Richard kept driving the Cycling Podcast Feminin, but that he was that bridge between the two podcasts, you know. And I always felt that was important, and I don't know why, but I did. So anyway, so it's lovely to have you. So thank you for chatting.
Well, I feel like I do feel a bit like I've been called up to a big race with little training. But as Lizzie Banks very generously said, I'm catching on reasonably quickly.
And we all know that what Lizzie Banks says is gospel. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Lionel, especially coming on knowing that you're off to the Giro. Your Giro saga begins imminently.
Super early, really. Tomorrow morning. We need to let you go and finish off your panic packing, as I tend to do the night before.
My panic packing, yeah, yeah. I'm over the weight limit on my suitcase at the moment, so I need to do a bit of redistributing.
Wear it. But, that's what I would do. Wear 10 layers.
Just one point of order. Just one point of order, a sort of not quite a corrections corner, but a clarifications corner. What was the blue colour?
Rose? Eve Klein.
Eve Klein. Yeah, well, the map jersey is actually space blue, but it is very, very close.
Have you
to
looked
Eve
up
Klein
Eve
blue,
Klein? Line
up. I've looked up Eve Klein and I've looked up space blue. I've looked up on the map website the Evade Pro Base long sleeve jersey, which is hanging on my wall behind me in space blue.
Okay.
Very elegant.
If anyone
very
wants
elegant,
to look up space
agree.
Blue and compare it to Eve Klein blue, then please do.
Hide
because
oh, no,
you'll find
I
that
was
they
going
look
to
very
ask how
similar.
It compares to Yves Saint Laurent blue, but Yves Saint Laurent blue is a lot brighter, isn't it? Anyway,
or is that just made up? Is what? Yves Saint Laurent blue?
Oh no, there's a very specific blue used by Yves Saint Laurent that's all over his gardens in Marrakesh. Which is the only
okay,
reason
well,
I know.
Oh, I see. Oh,
you see?
Very nice.
You see? I'm not making shit up,
similar.
Rose. I'm here for my
It is also similar.
It's quite similar to Yves Klein blue, but I wouldn't say the map one necessarily. There we go.
Well, now, hopefully, listeners,
Come for the cycling.
You're totally confused.
Stay for the chat about the variations in shades of blue.
Which we can't even demonstrate because it's a podcast.
50
but hopefully that's
blue.
Left everyone intrigued enough to go and look on the map website. So hopefully that's worked very nicely. But no, Lionel, we should let you go and get
Grazie mille.
Your packing.
Arrivederci.
All of your instant Nescafe coffee that you've no doubt will have packed. to survive the month. And Orla, I believe that you're at some kind of shindig shindig coming up.
I'm actually not. I'm depositing my children in Scotland so they can attend the shindig while I go to Bath to cover the Giro d'Italia
to work
from
on
there.
The Giro.
Yes. I'm recording from Scotland tonight because, or today, whenever you're listening, because my niece, also called Orla, is having her first Holy Communion this Saturday, and I couldn't let my kids miss out, so I brought them here, and then I'll fly on to Bath, and my husband and I will take them home.
How many communions do you get? How can it
well,
be the first
every,
one?
Every Mass, Rose.
Oh,
once you've had your
I
first
see.
Holy Communion, you keep receiving communion.
Oh.
Yeah. But you're not allowed to take communion until you've had your first Holy Communion. So, relevant question, but luckily I thought I was put on the spot there and then realised it was very easy. So,
no, phew, you realised it was just a dumb question. Yeah. Okay, good. Well, I'll leave you to that, Orla, and we'll gather next when we gather next,
we
I suppose. Is
yes,
what we'll
convene in about a month, shall we? Let's do that.
Perfect.
Thanks, guys.
See you then.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.